Welcome to episode 142 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and who matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Crystal Heath. Crystal is a full-time veterinary practitioner, as well as a journalist and an activist. She's the co-founder of Our Honor, a charity that's aiming to create an organized network of veterinary professionals who are able to challenge unethical institutionalized systems and amplify the voices of those who've been marginalized. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 141 others. Don't forget to work through that back catalog if you've just found us. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate and rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platforms. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Crystal. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I love your show, so I'm super excited to be here.
Brilliant. Well, it's an honor to have you as a listener and a watcher, and great to add you to the guest list. You've been on my wish list for a while. And we were just comparing, you're having your morning coffee while I'm probably breaking all the rules by having a coffee as we head into the London evening. But there's a synchronicity across the time zones there at least. So thank you so much for making the time to join Sentientist Conversations. And as you've listened to a few of these already, you know the story already, but I'm trying to focus these conversations relentlessly on what I think of as the two deepest and most important philosophical questions: what's real and who matters. And I have a clear agenda, which I can be very upfront about, because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which I summarize in a sentence as a commitment to evidence, reason, and having compassion for all sentient beings. So when we think about what's real and how to go about what to believe in, it suggests we should take a naturalistic approach using evidence and reason. And when it comes to morality, it says, you know, really simply, every sentient being should get our compassion, should be included in our scope of moral considerations. Any being that can suffer can experience flourishing, can experience anything at all, really. But I'm talking in these conversations to people who both disagree or agree with different aspects of that worldview. So it'll be fascinating to know your own philosophical story and how you put that into practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to dive into this. I would just love for these sorts of conversations to be had in veterinary schools. You know, when students are trying to figure out, you know, you're here to help animals, or that's maybe your job. And how does organized veterinary medicine maybe hinder some of those things? And should all vets maybe adopt a sentientism sort of philosophy?
Yeah, I agree. And that's partly why I focus on them, because it seems that there's something about the way humans intellectualize this stuff, that they're like, okay, those questions like what's real and who matters, they're sort of so basic. Let's move on to all of this more intricate, complex, challenging, difficult stuff. And I'm like, hold on, yep, that's fine. But you've got the answers to these questions fundamentally wrong. You're making catastrophic moral errors and sometimes epistemological errors. So we really need to get back to these basics. And we can still fight over all the other stuff, but these central questions of, you know, what reality is and how should we understand it and who should really matter in our moral scope, I think are absolutely central. That's why I'm sort of rather boringly banging the drum about them. And I agree. I think, you know, we'll come into this talking about the veterinary science world, but you could apply it to philosophy, you know, any other domain of human life. I think coming back to these basics is, you know, centrally important. And I'd love to see it as part of, you know, almost any educational curriculum that this way of thinking is at least considered. Sadly, it isn't. But we'll come back to that later on. And you've hinted already at your, you know, focus and the sorts of things you work on at the moment. But how would you introduce yourself to people who don't know of your work already?
Well, my name is Dr. Crystal Heath, and I'm a veterinarian who kind of recently joined the animal rights movement as of 2019, but I was always sort of very interested in animal rights from an early age. And this movement has kind of taken over my life. I am a full-time veterinarian. I work for a nonprofit spay neuter clinic, as well as animal shelters and some general practice, but I'm more recently the founder of a 501c3 nonprofit called Our Honor, and our mission is to empower veterinary students, veterinarians, and animal professionals to speak their conscience and confront systems of violence. And we support those who face bullying and retaliation for voicing ethical concerns and fighting for change. I'm also part of Compassionate Bay, whose mission is to pass animal and environmentally friendly legislation in California. And they were part of this coalition of groups that passed the fur ban in California. And that sort of led to a worldwide sort of collapse of the fur industry as many brands started moving away from fur. So just showing how legislation in California can impact the rest of the world. And I also just help out in a variety of other ways with various animal advocacy groups. I kind of jump in and out as needed. So that's sort of my agenda.
Yeah. So you're doing about 5 or 6 jobs on top of your full-time veterinary job.
Yes.
Thank you again for taking the time. I'm not sure quite how you're doing it. And it's interesting you talk about animal rights and veterinary science. And those two things clearly go so beautifully together because both are ultimately about caring about non-human animals. So I can't imagine you find any friction or bullying or challenge to integrating those two ways of thinking tightly together. I'm sure it's been plain sailing and Our Honor gets hardly any calls.
Hardly any. No, it's quite astonishing the resistance in the veterinary community to animal rights. And it's all started sort of based on how the veterinary industry was founded. I mean, it was founded on people who exploited animals and wanted to sort of use animals for our own benefit. And that is very much codified into the veterinary profession. And they actively keep out anybody with an animal rights agenda from entering the profession. So,
yeah. And we'll come back to that later on, because I think when we're talking about how to make a better world, shifting systems is one of the biggest problems we've got. And, you know, you're hitting one of those big core systems head on, and it's difficult and costly. So it'll be fascinating to dig into, you know, how you're making that happen and the resistance you're getting and your hopes for the future too. But I'm going to drag you back to these basic philosophy questions first before we get to that. So the first question about what's real, for many of my guests, that's a story about how they grew up originally in family and society that was maybe more religious or supernatural or spiritual or mystical in some sense, or one that was maybe more scientifically minded or naturalistic or atheist or agnostic or a mix of the two, and how that side of their thinking's changed over their life, if it has. So you can wind the clock back as far as you like to tell the story on epistemology and what's real.
Yeah, so I grew up with a family who was agnostic. We didn't really celebrate any sort of religion. We didn't go to church or anything like that. But we did celebrate Christmas, and we had a Christmas tree and everything like that. It was just kind of like how most people do where I grew up. And when I went to school, I remember elementary school, like people would ask around the holiday season, what are you, Christian or Jewish? Like that, those were the only two options that you had. And I was are we Christian or are we Jewish? And I think, you know, when I was little, they probably said, well, we celebrate Christmas, so we're Christian. But that was like the end of like, really our dive into kind of organized religion. But I remember sort of dealing with like, what do we believe at a very young age? Because we had a farm with lots of animals, and we'd rescue animals, and we'd actually rescue like little baby chicks from the feed store where we'd get feed for our horses and stuff. And many times they would die. And it was like, well, what happens when they die? You know, I kind of at a very young age was like pondering this whole thing. I was obviously very sad when they died, but like, what actually happens? And, you know, somebody described to me like, oh, their soul, you know, goes to heaven. And then I watched cartoons where they have like, where somebody dies and like their ghost rises. So I thought like, oh, maybe I could watch that when that happens, and never actually saw their soul rising. But I see now working in the veterinary profession how few young children really get to kind of think through and experience death from a young age. So many people I know have their first encounters with death are like much later in life, either they're late teenagers or, you know, early 20s or something. And it's like really shocking and kind of terrifying to them all of a sudden. They have such a hard way of dealing. It's such a hard concept for them. And it's so devastating. And it is very sad to like lose an animal or a loved one. But I don't feel like I have that same sense of trauma from it. So that's what I grew up in. And I obviously have like a very scientific mindset about it. But to me, it's not like devastating when it is sad. Like I'll miss them. I'm sad that they will no longer be around. But it doesn't hit the same way that it hits most people. And I'm like trying to figure out why that is. And I think one of the reasons is I kind of view like they're being released from this faulty body and allowed to go on. And that's where I will probably discuss with your next question of like naturalistic versus supernatural. Like, where do I stand there?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Thank you. And what did you think? So when you encounter people with a religious worldview, what did you think of it? Were you just sort of not particularly interested, or were you intrigued but rejected it, or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I actually remember like reading the Bible and just being like fascinated by it. I'm like, this is so beautiful, like these concepts and the way that they wrote it. So I was fascinated by it from like that perspective. Mm. And some of my friends would say things like, one friend who was Catholic didn't believe in organ donation. And so I would like argue with her about that. I'm like, why would you? I guess I don't know if this is a common Catholic belief, but it was something that she held, like she would not donate any of her organs. And I remember, you know, going to funerals and weddings and things like that. And I strongly had this response to like this idea that the wife had to obey and submit to the husband. Like that didn't seem like something I could jump on board with.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was younger, I still loved Ellen DeGeneres and her show Ellen, the sitcom. And when she came out as gay, you know, I was very happy for her. And I remember all these religious groups, like, you know, attacking the show. And I remember friends at school who were like, I can't watch that show. My parents wouldn't let me. And I'm like, really? Wow. So that was kind of like,
because being gay is an abomination against God, or.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it? Mind-blowing.
The whole religion thing seems really problematic. Beautiful, like, language in some of these things, but the way that it's been used by man to sort of maintain hierarchy and power structures is quite concerning.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But, you know, obviously there has been some good that came out of it, like people compelled to maybe treat each other better. Hopefully they realize some hypocrisy in treating certain classes of people and animals poorly. Hopefully those religions will reconsider those views. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of.
Yeah, thank you. And I do find it interesting, because I don't think it makes sense to sort of throw the whole enterprise out, because there's enormous value there that people find in community. Yeah. And most religions do have this sense of compassion running through them, and as you say, hopefully haltingly they can get a bit more universal about that compassion, and a bit less restrictive, and a bit less in-group out-group, and a bit less conditional, and a bit less follow the rules, otherwise awful things will happen to you, right? But there is that bedrock of compassion there, which is good. And I guess I sometimes, in my more challenging moments, I think that, okay, but all of the good stuff you can get from a religious worldview you can have without it. But the bad stuff that comes from a religious world, you can't really justify based on a naturalistic way of understanding. So I'm, you know, I don't discount there's good stuff in religion, but I don't think it's really dependent on the supernatural stuff either.
I wonder if like agnostics organized themselves in such a way, like it's all about the religion organizing itself, and then these organized groups of people using their power to oppress others. Like, that's kind of what happens with religion. Yeah. What if agnostics and atheists did organize themselves? Would they end up trying to oppress others, or would they not? I don't know. That would be, you know, something.
And I agree. It's interesting because I also don't think that being atheist, agnostic, or even naturalistic gives you necessarily a guarantee you'll have good ethics either. And you can, I think there's probably some interesting case studies where, you know, atheist groups, for example, have organized into communities that have then had their own very serious issues. Playing out today, right? So this, I don't think, you know, having a naturalistic epistemology guarantees that you'll have a good set of ethics. I think it probably makes it more likely. You know, I think there's a positive correlation, but that's partly why with sentientism, I suggest that we need both. It's not just evidence and reason, but you also need this clear compassion for all sentient beings. I don't think either is sufficient. But some people will say to me, look, if we just have evidence and reason, then people will automatically be led to a sentient-centric compassion. And I'm like, well, that's certainly the way I've gone. And I think that makes sense. But there are many people who claim they're committed to evidence and reason who arbitrarily restrict their compassion. So I'm not sure it's that automatic. And the same works the other way around, right? You can have a sentient-centric compassion for all sentient beings. And by definition, sentience is a, you know, it's a natural capacity. You know, you don't need souls or being made in the image of God. So it fits quite nicely with a naturalistic way of thinking. But at the same time, if you have that sentient-centric compassion, but have fabricated or unfounded or just incorrect beliefs, that can lead you to do, you know, really terrible things. So that's you know, I should get off my pedestal and lecturing, but that's partly why I think we need both that sort of epistemological baseline and a clear ethical one. And I think they correlate and they go together really nicely. They don't necessarily 100% flow from each other. So,
But if somebody does have a worldview that you appreciate, you know, that we think is beneficial, but they're just one individual, like, are they really able to affect change on a broader level if they're just one? So, like, there is some sort of need to organize people, but I guess having some sort of foundation structure of culture and values is super important if we are going to, like, wield some influence over this huge world.
I agree, right? I mean, I do tend to focus at a very sort of minimal level on just the worldview, which by definition is something people have in their heads. But I think you're right. You can also take that worldview and ripple it out into active movements and communities. But you can also take it as a set of principles into policy and governance and law and regulations at every level, right? You can take those, you know, the principles and run them through. I think you're right. You know, just focusing on the individual is not really going to pull the levers hard enough. And that's, again, something we'll come back to later on. So it sounds like, so you started out in an agnostic place. You know, learned about and came across people who had religious worldviews, but you didn't really feel the pull of, you know, a fear of death, which might take people down that route. You had some concerns about some of the ethical things you saw coming through, homophobia and sexism and so on. So it sounds like you were never really drawn to sort of classically religious way of thinking. And for some people like me, that you sort of just end up going down a pretty boring, naturalistic, atheistic route, and that's it. But for other people, and you were sort of hinting at this, they will say, look, what's happened with the formalized religions is that, you know, powerful men tens or hundreds or thousands of years ago have sort of imposed really reactionary, you know, culturally conservative ethics on the superstructure here. But maybe there's something at the essence that's been covered up by all of that. Maybe there is something supernatural or transcendent, or maybe, you know, we do go beyond once we die as well. So are there elements of that that are in your thinking?
Yeah. Can you have both? I mean, I am a science-based person. I'm a veterinarian, studied the science in all throughout college. But I think the more you study science, the more you realize there's some big unanswered questions here that science doesn't have the answers to. And that is, like, why am I here able to view the world only through my body, and why am I a body having an experience? And there are other bodies, I presume, maybe, that are also having an experience that is consciousness. Like, and where does consciousness come from? I've heard so many, like, naturalistic people say, well, consciousness is the result of chemicals and hormones and ions in your brain causing this experience. It's like, still, you're not getting to why I am here and you are there. And how did this happen? And where will we go elsewhere? And they insist that, you know, once you die, lights out. It's like, really? Then why now? Why are you in this place here now in this time? So I think there's some sort of something else, and that might be consciousness is a supernatural thing. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. And I think you're right, because quite often people who have a naturalistic or a scientific worldview can end up getting trapped in their own sort of dogma, because you can be so confident, you know, consciousness is just information processing in the neurons, that becomes its own, you know, you become closed-minded in that sense. You're like, no, I will not even entertain any other evidence or any other points of view. And to my mind, that cuts away at the heart of a naturalistic or a scientific worldview, right? Because when it's done properly, science has doubt at its center, and it has error correction at its center, and it has an open-mindedness to new evidence. And that doesn't mean you can't be very confident. If the evidence is really strong, you can be very confident. But being 100% confident just shuts the door, and it becomes its own form of dogma. So but it is a tricky balancing act, because I think I sometimes separate two ways of thinking about naturalism. One is a sort of ontological naturalism, which just says, look, I think the natural world is all that exists. There is no supernatural. So that's one way of thinking about naturalism. But I tend to focus more on the method. So the sort of epistemological bit about how do we actually work out what to believe and what credences to have, which is the evidence and reason bit of sentientism. And for me, they've sort of come together, because I use evidence and reason to try and work out what to believe. And that's led me to be quite confident that the natural world is all that exists. But that's not totally confident. Whereas there are other people who will say, well, you know, I'm committed to using evidence and reason to working out what to believe as well. I don't want to have unfounded beliefs. But that, thinking about the evidence I've seen and the reasoning I've done, has actually led me to be more open-minded than you, Jamie, about the possibility of, you know, supernatural stuff, even some things you might think of as are quite weird. So I think as long as we have a common commitment to that methodology, you can go any way you like. And I think you can be open-minded even to very deeply strange ideas. And we should, because modern physics is already deeply strange and is backed up by overwhelming evidence. But the trick for me is, there are some fascinating points where we're less confident of what the hell is going on, right? There's the origins of the universe. There's the origins of life. Although that's got less spicy over time, as we've understood more. There's absolutely the origins of consciousness and the nature of consciousness. And there can be a risk of a sort of God of the gaps thing, where in those spaces where we're less confident because the evidence is harder to come by, or we're just less sure, that people then put an answer in, and that can become its own dogma. So I guess the balancing act I'd like to try and find is one where we can be really open-minded about those crazy, deep, challenging, difficult questions, but let's not jump to a belief in an answer before we actually have some evidence. So, you know, we can be comfortable saying, I don't know, and I'm open-minded about these different ideas, and let's keep thinking it through. And we may never find the answer, right? Because there's no guarantee that us humble humans will ever get perfect answers, right? So it's an interesting balancing point. But I think at the very least, my credence in those types of things might be maybe lower than yours, but I still have a probability there that says it's possible, right? It's possible conceptually.
Yeah, I love the quote that's essentially all models are wrong, but some are useful. Yeah. That's by George Box, who's a statistical person, status person, statistics person.
Yeah.
I mean, can we use some models for good? What are the models that we base kind of our decisions on? And I think it's important. So you are, I have a question for you about sentientism.
Yeah.
So sentience versus consciousness, though, like, do you have is there a difference between the two for you?
Yeah. Let's talk about it. It doesn't matter which section it comes in, right? It doesn't matter
which section. Conversation here.
No, it's brilliant, because I find this stuff fascinating. So of course, it depends, and those definitions are fuzzy and they move around and they evolve over time. So let's put that to one side. The way I tend to think of sentience is that it's the morally salient component of consciousness. So quite a lot of people have quite a rich definition of consciousness. So they talk about a sense of awareness, but they also talk about a sense of the self. They talk about maybe some degree of cognitive capacities and intelligence gets bundled in. They talk about an ability to plan for the future. Some people even talk about creativity as being a requirement for consciousness. So it becomes quite a rich, heavy thing.
Interesting.
And sometimes, not always, but sometimes. So so my perspective is, well, that's all very interesting, but the morally salient component of that consciousness is just the experience, the ability to have the experiences themselves, particularly valenced experiences, you know, things we feel are good or bad, essentially to experience suffering or flourishing, defined very, very broadly. So in that way, I'm suggesting that sentience is the morally salient subset of consciousness. That's one answer. But it's quite interesting because I've had the pleasure of talking to some people with a panpsychist worldview, and I don't know if you've come across that, but it sounds like you might like the idea because they don't necessarily think that consciousness is supernatural, but they do think that consciousness is a distinct, ineffable, ultimately private aspect of the real world that is distinct from, in some way, the physical stuff that's going on in our heads. And they also think that because, and they'll correct me, right, because I'm probably getting this wrong, but they also think that because there is no sort of magical dividing line between what's going on in my mind at the moment and the information processing that is even going on all the way down to fundamental particles, that maybe at some level, even an electron has a vanishingly simple micro consciousness. And maybe that's what has given rise to our awareness as well.
Yeah.
So in that sense,
I've been compelled by that too. That idea of like subunits of consciousness, that we're all made up of subunits of consciousness. And within ourselves, we have multiple consciousnesses. And that's, you know, if you do have a brain damage or experience brain damage or something like that, then that might dampen some of your consciousness and bring out other parts.
Yeah. And you can take that into sort of whether systems have some form of awareness or consciousness as well. So the classic thing about thinking about termite or ant colonies, and, you know, is there some level of awareness there, not just intelligence? And I'm personally skeptical of that, but in a way the panpsychists sort of take that back the other way, even to super simple stuff, and say maybe there's some, you know, tiny element of micro consciousness all the way down.
I think even humans, like you talk about ants having consciousness, but I think masses of humans have a consciousness. I mean, and even just you think of one human interacting with another, I am sort of, some people bring out a different side of my humanity or expose me to different ways of thinking. And when you have groups of people, that group has a different way of thinking than the each individual people who make up that group. So I think
you'll like panpsychism, and you should look into one of the central challenges they've got is that in a way they almost have an echo of the materialist problem. So I'm more of a materialist, right? I do think that sentience is just a class of information processing that we happen to have evolved because it was useful in an adaptive context to want to go towards good things and away from bad things. So I'm more of a materialistic mindset, although I have an open mind about panpsychism. But in a way, I have this problem of that I think you already hinted at, of, okay, but how can neurons and atoms, you know, be put together in a way that is conscious, right? So from my point of view, that's analogous to putting lines of code together and getting PowerPoint. It's just a system, right? There's nothing magically different there. But a panpsychist will say, no, you're missing the essence of the problem, right? You're saying you put a load of neurons together and now they're firing, but how does it get from that to consciousness? Yeah. Because from a panpsychist worldview, there's this sort of assumption that consciousness itself must be something distinct from the information processing, whereas I don't feel that assumption at all. So, but the panpsychists have an analogous problem. So in the same way as I'm like, okay, how can I explain how atoms and neurons can fire together to generate consciousness? panpsychists have a similar problem, which they call the problem of the combination problem, which is, okay, even if electrons and photons and quarks and really simple stuff have some micro consciousnesses, how do those combine into something that we might recognize as animal consciousness, which is in a way is a sort of analogous problem to the one that the materialist is facing. But I think you might quite like that. And there's another paper that you might like by a philosopher called Eric Schwitzgebel, who I've had a few chats with, who wrote a great paper called "Is the United States Conscious?" And he's making this same point of, if consciousness is really just different elements interacting and passing information around, well, doesn't the US qualify? So again, I'm skeptical because I think the US and actually groups of humans lack that evolutionary adaptive context. I think we're doing things in a different way that mean I don't think a group is aware in any sense that's distinct from the minds of the individuals in it. And I don't think the US is conscious. But at the same time, it is quite hard to work out, where exactly are there any dividing lines, and isn't it all just information processing, and how does it all plug together? And in a way, my sense of it's all just information processing all the way down, in a way, is not that different than panpsychist view of everything's conscious all the way down. Yeah. But where I was coming to is this gives me a different answer to your, how are consciousness and sentience different? Because to a panpsychist, I might say, well, okay, let's grant for the moment that an individual quark or an electron or a photon has a vanishingly simple microconsciousness. Although, again, I struggle because photons, time doesn't even pass for them because they're moving at the speed of light. So you're really stretching what I think of as consciousness, because for a photon's consciousness, if it has this microconsciousness, this is a consciousness without time passing, without light, without sound, without touch, without senses, without nociception, without interoception, without proprioception. Anything I think of as the characteristics of my consciousness, this photon does not have. So that leads me to say, that's why I don't think it makes sense to call it conscious, because it's just so radically different from the way I use the term and my experience of consciousness that I think it's something different. But if a panpsychist wants to say, no, I'm still going to call that a microconsciousness, the next question is, okay, but is it sentient? Because I would argue that if a photon is minimally microconscious in that sense, that has no nociception, no ability to respond, none of the stuff going on in the photon that's going in my head, that it might be microconscious in a panpsychist sense, but then it's not sentient. It can't actually experience suffering or flourishing, because I don't think there's anything you can do to an electron or photon that it would ever care about. I don't think it has the capacity to care at all. So in that sense, my first answer to your question was, sentience is like a subset of consciousness. But in this situation, we've got something that maybe is a microconsciousness that isn't sentient and therefore doesn't warrant our compassion. That was a massively long answer, but I find it fascinating.
I get it. I saw kind of one definition was that like all sentient beings are conscious, but a conscious being may not be sentient. Like if they have no way of feeling or experiencing, but these conscious beings, even these like subunit, very small particles, if they're able to like perceive, to make a decision and act, that is something. And I've heard various people say, like, if you look at, very small particles, that whole like quantum theory situation of you have a wave represents sort of like all of the ways that they react and making a decision. And then once you're a conscious observer who actually observes that specific particle, then you see it as a particle, not a wave, in a specific point in time in the universe and location.
And you can get into some real quantum weirdness there, and there's deep weirdness, like uncertainty being built into the core of the system. It's not just uncertainty and not being able to find it out. It's just that is actually an aspect of the reality. But I do get very hesitant about where we start, because the observer of that collapses a quantum wave, and some people don't think it's a collapse. Some people think it's a spawning of multiple universes, but that observer doesn't actually have to be conscious. So I think there's another danger there of, and us humans like doing this, of sort of, in one sense, I think we have a long history of making humans the center of everything, you know, from the Copernican worldview, from, you know, a God that conveniently looks like us and made us in his image. You know, there's lots of things about we must be the center of everything. And then science teaches us, hold on a minute, you're just another animal. And there's 400 billion other galaxies with 300 billion stars in each of them. And you sort of are pulled away from that anthropocentric view. And I sometimes worry we do that with consciousness as well. And the panpsychists get annoyed with me because I think many of them have a super humble way of thinking about panpsychism, where they'll say, look, this is really humble. We're saying what's going on in our heads is not special at all. We're not special. We're so unspecial that even a photon is conscious. Yeah. Whereas I think and I quite like that motivation.
It's like,
right?
The evolution of the plants feel pain, people. Like, and that's therefore you can't care about anything.
And that's part of the danger of these conversations, because I think we should look with clear eyes at these problems, but some of them do pop up as just, you know, meat troll comments, right? Where you know they're acting in bad faith. But there's another motivation which I do worry about, which is, you know, and I understand it because my consciousness is the only thing I know ultimately. Everything else I know is through my consciousness, right? I cannot escape it. I cannot escape my perspective. It is, of course, by definition, central. It's everything for me, everything. So the temptation to then take that consciousness, which is awesome and amazing and mind-blowing and literally everything to me, and finding ways to insert it in other places, even to the extent of saying maybe it's the foundation of all physics, I'm just like, I'm not so sure, right?
A bit egotistical there.
Maybe. But many panpsychists don't think that way. They think in this deeply humble way of, you know, we're not special at all. We just happen to be a combination, a particular combination of essential consciousness. But let me draw you back to this, because I could talk about this all day, and I am sorry, because I want to get back onto your work as well. But it's really important to the second question of what matters, because, you know, my view is sentience is the only qualifying thing you need as an entity to be morally considered for us to, you know, feel compassion for you. And in a sense, this sentientism idea, despite my personal views, is totally neutral on that sort of philosophy of mind stuff. So you can be a panpsychist, you can be a materialist, you can be an illusionist, whatever. There's loads of different ways of thinking about that. And you might have different views about how distributed it is and how it might be graded as well. So I've talked to people like Luke Roloffs and a few others who have a panpsychist worldview on previous episodes too. But I guess what sentientism says is whatever it is, wherever it is, it matters, right? In another way of putting it, all suffering should matter regardless of where it is or what it is. So it deliberately sort of skips over some of those contentious questions about, okay, what is the nature of sentience and how does it relate to consciousness? And just says, you know, even if my consciousness and my sentience is an illusion, right, which some people say there is a field of philosophical thought where they respond to your challenge by saying the whole thing is an illusion. There is no such thing as a distinct consciousness at all. It still hurts if I stick a fork in my hand, right? So you can philosophize as much as you like, but that matters. And I think that matters to other sentient beings too. So that's the grounding of, that's the sentient bit. But I should ask you the question because I'm supposed to be interviewing you instead of rambling on. But the second question, what matters, there's two parts to it in a way. One is for people who don't have a formalized religious worldview like you or me, we don't have, you know, Bible or the Bhagavad Gita or the Torah or, you know, the Quran to give us a list of what's good and bad. And we also don't have a deity looking after over our shoulders with a carrot and a stick and, you know, threatening us with burning in hell for eternity if we do something wrong, right? So we don't have that stuff, I think is great. Thank you. But the first question is, you know, what do good and bad and right and wrong even mean for you in the context of your worldview? And how have you gone about thinking about that?
And when starting this nonprofit too, it's like we want to set some sort of like core value, like how do we determine what policies we support and what we're about and what we go after, like how do we make some decisions about what matters? And so we kind of simplified it to, well, we work for the best interests of all species, or, you know, no matter their species, we want what's in their best interest.
Yeah.
So trying to like go through the world and deciding what's in the best interests of the species I'm interacting with. And then but that it gets tough too. Like obviously there's some easy decisions that need to be made. Like what we're doing in large scale animal agriculture is a horror. And even if, I mean, I am kind of like one of those people who thinks plants matter, but if we want to save plants, then the best thing to do is not feed them to billions of animals who are suffering. So that's, yeah. You know, we can kind of get there. You had on the show previously, Matt Johnson, and we've talked about this before, his kind of idea of, I don't know if he named it this or I named it this petri dish of euphoria, where like, you're going to start an organization, you're going to like build this like small example of like, what is like the ideal way that, you know, ensuring the happiness of like this tiny little petri dish. Or he gives an example, sanctuary, where you have like two dogs and your just goal is to like do the best you can for these dogs. And, you know, so looking at the world through that perspective, and then how do you expand it out? So, you know, I think just going in with that mindset of like, how do I not harm others as I walk through this life? But at the same time, like I get a parasite in my intestine. Is it wrong for me to want to rid myself of that parasite?
Yeah. Or should you provide sustenance to that tapeworm and in a compassionate way? Yeah.
And maybe the world isn't quite ready for that discussion, but at least animal agriculture, let's go back to that. Like, let's scale that down. And then we can talk about the parasite in my intestine.
Yeah. And I like that approach, because I think you're right. There are, you know, there are really difficult problems. There may not be good solutions. There's enormous complexity. You've got that question about demandingness as well, right? How far should we go to trying to help others and so on? But I think at least setting the baseline for moral inclusion and that scope is something we should all be able to agree on. And then we can struggle over all the other stuff, but let's get the baseline right, as we talked about before. And I like the way you talked about interests, because again, I think that's almost the tautological core of most well-grounded moralities, is it's a choice about whether and how to care about the interests of others. I'm not sure what else morality can be. And there will be people who will talk about egoistic or relativistic or, you know, nihilistic ethics, mm-hmm. and say, well, these are forms of ethics. And I'm like, well, maybe, but those to my mind are forms of ethics that have just abandoned morality, because if you don't ultimately have some concern for others and their interests, I'm not sure you really count as even trying to be moral anymore. And so I like that idea of interest, but there may be another difference here that you hinted at, because I tie the idea of interest quite tightly to this concept of sentience. So I think every sentient being by definition has interests, because every sentient being can feel good things and bad things. So they have an interest in avoiding the bad and getting the good, right? And that could be anything from, you know, sustenance, survival, warmth, shelter, freedom from pain, all the way through to, you know, relationships, family, love, well-being, you know, feelings of existential angst, love. I mean, it could be anything, right? So, but all of those are interests to my mind, and every sentient being has interests by definition because they are sentient.
Interests versus happiness. A lot of people say like, oh, the pursuit of happiness, like, is happiness really the end? I always struggled with like happiness, and should we be working for the happiness of others? Does that matter, or just whatever they're interested in what their existence is? So I felt like interest was like a better thing to go for than happiness.
Yeah, I do too, because I think you're trusting the individual to have a view about what they want and respecting that view, and you're trying to value what they value, not imposing something you think they should value. So yeah, I quite like that approach of interest. But you talked about caring about plants, and I guess there's a couple of ways you can go here, and I'd be interested in your answer, because one approach is to say, well, look, I think there's a possibility that plants might be sentient. You know, it might be a low probability, I'm not sure, but there's a possibility. And because they're possibly sentient, they have interests and therefore I should care about them. But there's a different approach, which is to say, I don't think plants are sentient. You know, I'm open-minded, but I'm pretty confident they don't. But even if they're not, even if they can't experience anything, they still have interests in a sense, because you know, they want warmth and they want to grow and they want to spread seeds and spores and so on. So do you tie interest and sentience together, or do you think of interest as being broad enough to include, you know, non-sentient beings? And maybe even, you know, does the thermostat in our house have an interest in achieving the target temperature? How far can you push this idea?
Yeah, I mean, the thermostat isn't like living there. It's life. So it's not like reproducing, growing, you know, going about its life. So
It has goals, though. It really wants to get 18 degrees.
I don't know if it has its own goals or if its goals are just mine. So I'm drawing the line at the thermostat, and I'm saying hey, plants though, plants have an interest, but like at what point, here's where it gets tricky. If you have a species and they have an interest in like reproducing very rapidly, where they destroy, you know, in a natural wild setting where they destroy everything around them. And this has happened several times throughout history, is species go extinct because of another species. Do we just let that happen because that's nature and that's the evolution of how things go? Or do we intervene and say no? Is maybe humanity might be doing that to itself right now, but you know, there are certainly other species who are doing this in various areas, like the feral pig problem that we have here. Like what's the ethical way to go about that? And it's super challenging to struggle with these things. And you really have to dive in, and we don't always have the answers. So
I don't think we should pretend we have the answers. So when you're talking about, you know, liminal animals or animals that, you know, overlap with our spaces or the spaces of other animals, you know, the whole problem of wild animal suffering, I think, is really deep and challenging. And we shouldn't necessarily pretend we have easy answers. But I do think that if we have this sort of at least a sentientist stance, because I'm more interested in making sure we've got all the sentient beings included than I am about excluding other stuff, right? My view is, if you want to go further, that's fine, but let's make sure every sentient is included. But I think if you have that stance of caring about every sentient being, you're much more likely to come up with better approaches. It might not be perfect, it might not be the right thing, but you're more likely to find a better way forward. Because quite often, I think, you know, traditional human thinking looks at those problems and the default answer is kill them all, or you know, something else. Whereas quite often, if you take a sentientist stance, you can come up with other ideas, whether it's, you know, contraception or fencing or some other creative approach of just finding a different way of living together. It doesn't mean there's going to be some sort of utopian perfect way forward, but at least setting that baseline so that we morally consider every sentient being included gives us a better chance of it. So, yeah. So,
absolutely.
Again, it's really hard to segregate these things, but you know, that the center of that sort of what matters question is about the interests of others. So that's absolutely fascinating. And it's really clear already how you've answered my second question, which is who matters, which is, you know, any being that has an interest, and you're drawing the line at the thermostat, but you'll go pretty generously beyond that too. So I'm interested in your journey about how you came to that, because one of the things I find in a lot of these conversations is that I can imagine someone listening to the first part of the conversation where we're talking about what's real and they're going, yes, 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 that's fine. And then we talk about what matters, and we talk about compassion and interests and, you know, valuing others as they value themselves and caring. And they go, yes, 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 of course, of course. And then we get to the bit where we talk about non-human animals and their brain melts, right? Because their mindset is stuck in only considering humans as valid moral patients, right? That is the cultural default in pretty much everywhere around the world at the moment. So how did you go through that journey? Because you talked about early experiences with non-human animals. How did you go through that journey of, one, recognizing some non-human animals as valid moral patients, then all certainly sentient non-human animals as valid patients, and then progressively putting that into practice? What was that like for you?
Yeah. So, okay, I should bring up this story of, you know, I grew up in very rural area where we had lots of animals and stuff. And I was in 4-H, and which is a group that raises animals for for agriculture purposes, many kids raise animals for slaughter.
And it's a government program, is that right? It's a government sort of an industry educational program?
It's a government program, yeah, run by our land grant schools or land grant universities that were set up for the promotion and research into agriculture.
I can probably look it up, but do you know how big it is? Because, I mean, how many kids might go through this on an average?
You know, it might have gotten a lot smaller in recent years, but it's like millions of kids are involved with this. Like anybody in rural areas are involved. And another similar one is FFA, which is Future Farmers of America, which is in high schools. Many rural high schools have this program too. So I grew up in that and I decided, you know, that I was in the goat project, you know, which is just raising dairy goats. But once I learned that, I had to, if my goat had a baby and that baby was a boy, I'd have to send them to slaughter. I decided, no, I'm not about that. Like, I love bottle feeding my babies. I love milking goats, but I am not going to contribute to this system where the baby goats are killed, you know, just so we could have milk and that whole thing. So my goats were just pets after that. But another kind of what shaped my philosophy early on, or kind of what I was exposed to, that was this, I rode horses and I did dressage, which is this training of horses where it's based in like military training, where you teach them all of these different movements and such. And one of my instructors was this guy named Charles DeComfy, and he's like your classic stereotypical riding instructor, like he's of nobility, like from the Hungarian noble class, very old, skinny man, you know, trained Olympians. And he was like very much ingrained in the Baroque philosophy and would teach us while he was teaching us riding all about the Baroque philosophy, which is like, there are two classes. There's the noble class, and then there's the food producing class. And there's man's job is to subdue nature and to turn it into something beautiful. And
it was that explicit.
Yeah. He literally talked about, like, in some of his talks about the importance of like increasing corn yields and like increasing milk production, like taking the corn, you know, that in its natural state isn't worth anything. And then like increasing corn yields and taking a cow and making the cow more, optimizing the cow to produce more milk and turning the horse into something beautiful. Like the wild horse on their own isn't anything that's beautiful, but, you know, through grooming and gymnastic training, we turn their movements into something beautiful.
And genetic selection.
And genetic selection, absolutely. And he also talks about the importance of horses is they teach character to the nobility, because they teach these characteristics of like courage, patience, discipline, and humility. And the horse is a better teacher for the children of the nobles than any nun or teacher could ever be. And he has this quote where he says, basically, in payback for humans taking care of the horse, the horse elevates the human from a nasty, disgusting 11-year-old creep into a gorgeous ruler sitting on a throne who benefits the nation he rules. And at that point, I'm wait a minute. Like, rulers throughout history not necessarily always benefited the nation they rule, especially like, and the world. I mean, these are like, we're talking about very colonialist nations. So this whole philosophy is highly problematic.
Just harking back to our earlier conversation, was there a religious element to his thinking, or was it just pure elitism and sort of human, some of us are born to lead? And
I think there is some sort of basis in God, but I should look up what his religious views are.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think he talks about God a little bit, but I don't know in what context. But that's
like it was more centrally focused on, you know, a certain class of humans born to lead, and, you know, maximal exploitation is the path to glory. And exactly. That's incredible, isn't it? Incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's I appreciate that. Like, but there is, can we like take that philosophy and make it more compassionate? Like, okay, humans are this species. We're unique that we know of in all the species, and that we can recognize suffering of others. We can heal the suffering of others. Like, I can do surgery and take off a cancerous mass or fix a broken leg. Can other species do that?
I think they can. I think they can recognize and care about the suffering of others. I don't think humans invented compassion, but yeah.
I mean, I've seen like the videos where like a turtle is overturned and the other turtles come over and flip them over, or like a elephant rescues somebody who's drowning.
Yeah.
So they definitely recognize suffering, but they can't really. They can only do so much.
That's like the thing, right? So and our strategist, like a salmon that just pumps out spawn, I don't think feels much affection for them. But the K strategists that have small families and care about them, I think mothers and kids, you know, care about each other long before humans came on the scene. But I think you're absolutely right that, you know, we have for good or ill, an unparalleled power to do something about that, right? One way or the other. So, yeah.
Yeah. But kind of in this pursuit of lack of suffering too, we have caused great harm, like in animal experimentation. Maybe billions of animals, you know, used in animal experimentation to develop cures, hundreds of millions of mice every year.
Yeah.
And we've confined animals to produce, you know, for the good of like providing nutrition to humans, but we've caused immense large scale suffering, you know, how many billions of animals every year. But can we like flip that Baroque script and be like, well, our job as humans is nature is suffering. Let's try to minimize suffering, work for the best interests of all species, use our powers and gifts for the good.
Yeah. And that's exactly the challenge of the final question about how can we make a better future. But if you can just finish off the story for me about how you went from, you know, you're clearly caring about individual goats and you didn't want them to be killed, and you had the experiences with dressage and with this Baroque philosophy, how did you get from there to sort of a more universal recognition that all animals matter, and playing that through, you know, your life practically? What was the rest of that journey to?
Yeah, it's kind of like you get bits and pieces over time as you kind of go on. And you know, when I was little, like you got some PETA stuff and you're like, oh hey, like I guess some people don't eat animals, so that can be a thing that's done, and trying to adopt that, but then getting pushed back from your parents who are like concerned that maybe you won't be healthy. And I'm already like, when I was little, I was a skinny kid. And I think my parents were already really worried. Like, I was not athletic at all. I was just very scrawny, very short for my age. And I was a twin too. So like being born very small. So I think they were super worried about that. And, but you know, as you gather more information, you learn like, this is a thing that you can do. And I think once I left home, I started only eating, plants, and I had some dairy and eggs and stuff just cause I couldn't get my act together. But, you know, once you develop good habits over time, you realize you can exclude animal products from your diet. And so that's kind of how it evolved. And then I moved to Berkeley and met a whole bunch of people who were working in this whole movement for animal rights, and found it quite compelling, like their whole philosophy of how we can actually change the world from animals in a relatively short period of time if we all join together and organize and make it happen. And comparing it to social justice movements of the past, like the women's suffrage movement, like gay rights, like civil rights, the abolitionist movement, like we can follow in their footsteps, do the same thing and create a vastly better world for all of us. And it affects everything. It affects our environment. It affects other humans. It affects the workers and who are forced to work in these facilities and forced to kill animals for hours every day.
Yeah.
So we can do an immense amount of good if we organize and make this thing a reality. So that's kind of
Like it. Thank you. And that's framed this final question perfectly about how can we make a better future? Because you've already said it's a question of, you know, can we flip humanity's role into basically being a force for good when it comes to thinking about sentient kind or sentientity and more broadly? And your introduction to this world of animal advocacy, and as you said, thinking about it as the next wave of social justice and learning those lessons and driving change forward, that framed, I guess, the sort of mission of your life from that point onwards. So what might be best to do in this section, you can go anywhere you like when answering the question, how can we make a better future? Because I'd love to know, you know, your thoughts on different change levers or, you know, what the blockers are and so on. But it might be interesting to zero in on, I guess, veterinary science and that institution and those systems as the central case study of your life. Because as I was slightly subtly saying earlier on, I think people would look at medical science and say, look, what is the purpose of medical science? And most people would say, of course, there are commercial interests and there's other stuff going on. And there's an intellectual interest in the science of the human body. But the core really is about compassion for humans and trying to help them have healthy, positive, fulfilling lives. That's really the essential mission of medical science. And I think many people might expect a similar story from veterinary science. But what would you say is today the current central core mission of veterinary science, and how did that come to be formed?
Well, I think they do. I mean, I can just read like the oath of the AVMA. They do want to relieve animal suffering.
And that's the American Veterinary Medical Association.
But they also, there's this thing about protecting animal resources and public health, and which public health is super important, but I think they view the role of the current animal agriculture system as a way to feed the public and as using animals in an exploitative way as a way to develop the medicines we need for public health. And I think they just need to develop a different mindset around this, that maybe these things are actually harming public health instead of helping public health. And so I was kind of very naive, kind of going into this whole thing thinking like, oh, like there's all this information that I wasn't taught in vet school about things. And, you know, I realize now that we can move away from animal agriculture, that we don't need it to feed the planet. And that meant much of the experimentation that we do on animals actually hurts people. So I start, you know, talking about this, you know, in various online forums to my colleagues. And then all of a sudden, this backlash and this pile on happens. And I realized like, whoa, there is this huge resistance to this. And people started telling me stories about how they tried to get into vet school. And because they were vegan, they were questioned, you know, a lot more. If they'd worked with an animal rights organization, their interviewers questioned them. And we found out like there's a producer, an animal ag producer, there's a animal researcher on nearly every veterinary school admissions board sort of protecting their interests. So we have people
So to be clear, expressing compassion for non-human animals and putting that into practice through boycotting the use of animal products is actually seen as a risk by those veterinary colleges.
Yeah. And there's certain science that they put out there. One is that we just don't have enough land to grow enough food for to feed everybody. And this is, it seems to be like really disingenuous. Like, I don't know, do they actually believe this, or are they really, really thinking this through? Are they so just in their own mindset of protecting these animal ag interests that they're
it seems strange that veterinary scientists and vets would not understand the basic economics of feed conversion ratios. Does seem weird, right? Because of course the opposite is true, right? We could produce double the amount of food with half the amount of agricultural land globally if we switch to plants, because the inefficiency of animal ag is breathtaking. So yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Do they actually coming back to the themes of this conversation, right? Have they sort of abandoned their epistemology because they need to make up fake stuff to continue, or do they genuinely believe it, or what? How is this working? It's weird.
Back and forth on if they actually believe this, or if there is just a real clear agenda. But the fact that we, you know, when we try to reach out to them to have a discussion about these things, they do not want a discussion. They do not want to discuss with us. And when you
get to, it can't even be talked about. It's not just
where it can't be talked about. Yeah, that's when this is very, very concerning. When I post things in veterinary Facebook groups and I get blocked and removed for trying to have these conversations.
Really?
When I reach out to people at the American Veterinary Medical Association and then they don't respond to my emails. When journalists reach out to people in organized veterinary medicine and they don't respond to journalists, like, this is clearly just power structures and how they maintain their power. They want to shut down the conversation. So we have to continue to have the conversation, put our evidence out there. Like, yes, you can feed the world without animal agriculture. Their narrative is we need to convert this non-arable land to protein to feed us. And they ignore the fact that a large percentage of arable land that we can grow crops on actually is used to feed animals. And we could grow all of the food we need on this arable land. And we don't even need to make use of all of this non-arable land that is currently used for grazing. They cherry pick the data. They ignore science to serve their own agenda. They view anything that kind of says otherwise as suspect. So that's what we're trying to empower those of us who believe that we should have compassion for all species. We are on the fringes right now. We organize, we empower ourselves, and then work towards the center. This is how social movements happen. Gradually, you know, we will take on more of a leadership role, hopefully in organized veterinary medicine, and change the way that they've codified things.
And the robustness of the pushback, I was amazed and shocked at how serious that can get, because from hearing you in other places, there's not just the personal shutdown you have of being kicked out of groups, but there's bullying, aggression, challenge, risk to career, threats. And that's one of the sad things, right? When you look at the ourhonor.org website and there are testimonials there, and quite a few of them are anonymous because people can't express this basic generous compassion for animals as vets because it's a risk to their careers.
It's really sad, and how students are afraid to even challenge their deans. Like, things like terminal surgeries, where students are forced to kill their surgical patient in their surgical training, which is something that doesn't need to happen anymore. Like, I never had to kill my patient in surgery training. We had an access to care model. I learned under the guidance of experienced surgeons. And now surgery is my favorite part of practice. And these students are forced to, like, participate in this highly unethical practice of killing completely healthy patients just for their benefit. And not getting the chance to see their patient wake up from surgery to advise their caretakers on care going forward.
How much of those sorts of practices, because there are, I guess there are a few different things we can touch on, right? One of them is the challenge that the veterinary science institution enabling animal agriculture and all of its horrors, which you've talked about already. Then there's the relation of veterinary science with animal testing, which again you touched on before, much of which, even in purely human terms, seems to be a very low effectiveness and is just being done because that's the way we've always done it and doesn't really seem to have any rationale behind it. And then there's the practices within veterinary training itself, as you talked about. And with things like those terminal surgeries, again, do you get the sense it's just this is always the way we've done it? Or is there something explicit in the training that is trying to get you to emotionally detach from your patients? Is there something explicit about you have to show you can be hard-hearted enough here.
Absolutely. There, that's the kind of the mindset of the past that's sort of still there in veterinary profession, just that this idea that you have to be tough. And it kind of, I think it kind of all relates to this sort of imposter syndrome that happens when, you know, you have these young 20-year-old students. It's very hard to get into vet school. They've made it. They don't want to appear weak. And it kind of perpetuates this culture of like being hard-hearted and a hard ass. And that's what gets you ahead. And this historically was a very male-dominated culture. And unfortunately, that's how in our patriarchal society, men interact with each other sort of in this way. Not all men, but some do.
Yeah. Like caring is a sign of weakness.
Yeah. And so they didn't have any women in the field. They didn't really allow women. I remember somebody said who graduated in like 1970, he was like, the only reason a woman becomes or enters vet school is because she's looking for a rich husband. It's like, it's so funny. But now, you know, there are more women, but that culture is still sort of there. And especially women are very much victim to this whole imposter syndrome thing. And we're always feeling like we're not good enough and we have to prove ourselves. So, and any view of like being too soft-hearted is sort of shunned. And it's just kind of this culture that needs to disappear. We need to be aware that this exists and it's not right and it needs to change.
Yeah. So let's switch from that because I find it deeply shocking. It's not surprising, but it's deeply shocking. And it's a really painful example of what it's like as an individual, as a small group of individuals, to go up against a system, frankly. Because you're also part of that community, right? It's not you're not criticizing from outside so you can retreat. This is your career and your life, and you know you're on the mailing list and you're going to the forums and you're in these communities. I think that makes it almost even harder than someone who's criticizing animal agriculture from the outside, right? Because you are part of the veterinary science system. But at the same time, that gives, you know, hope that you've got a much better chance of changing because you're in there and you can get some levers of power and things will change. So let's come on to that. But I'm interested in what proportion of, I guess, AVMA members or medical vets, either in the US and around the world, what proportion of their careers are locked into animal agriculture specifically? Because I think one of the things I'm interested in getting my head around is, you know, what's the scale of I like the idea of just transitions where we can try and take a current state to a target state while being compassionate for the people involved in the system. And if we were to imagine that transition for veterinary science, you know, how big a challenge is it if we're going to ultimately disconnect from agriculture and other forms of animal harms?
Yeah. So, okay. In the United States, there's 121-ish thousand veterinarians. And I always forget how many are working in like animal agriculture. It looks like, so 57,000 of them are your dog and cat vets. That's most of us. And then 3,800 are actually food animal practice. 2,700 are mixed practice. And then, you know, there's others who work for industry. This is probably like your people who do experimentation in academia. There's a lot of animal experimentation in academia too. So 5,900 in academia, and then there's 3,200 in industry. And we had this campaign that was against mass killing of animals via heat stroke. And this was our Veterinarians Against Ventilation Shutdown campaign, where animals are killed in response to the avian influenza outbreak. And we have close to 1,500 veterinarians sign on to that. And, you know, there's this Erica Chenoweth 3.5% number of, like, if you have 3.5% of a population engaged in regular advocacy and organized, then you can create change. So there may be some shaky things about that data, but I think we have the numbers needed to
make
real change for animals within the veterinary profession. So we just have to get organized and go about things in the right way.
Yeah. Thank you. And without giving too many secrets of your campaign away, how do you see that playing out? Is it a combination of challenge and guilt and shame, as well as providing people with encouraging them towards better alternatives and making it easy for them to make switches? Is it about persuading more individual vets to come on board? Is it about, you know, policy and regulation at different levels of the way veterinary organizations are run? What's your sense of, you know, the levers you're going to pull to get there?
Yeah. I have seen several times in my career radical shifts in the veterinary profession. And one of those is sort of this embracing of access to care in low-cost spay neuter, even though the AVMA was very much against low-cost spay neuter as like devaluing our profession and very against kind of low-cost veterinary care. And now there's been a shift, and it's just because, you know, the right messaging repeatedly, they had put forth science, like making good case studies about various things, and then messaging, making continuing education programs about this, and empowering others to speak out. Like when somebody starts bad mouthing low cost spay neuter or access to care, you can put forth the study and saying like, no, actually, this is good for our profession. This is good for the animals. And that helps empower people to speak up. And if we have science that shows, you know, these vegans and animal rights activists within our profession are being bullied, if we are able to show that the way animals are treated in animal agriculture is harmful to their welfare, it's harmful for our welfare, it hurts our profession's reputation as caring advocates for animals. There's so many directions we can go with like studies and case studies that we could put forth in the literature, and then create messaging around them, and then message that to the veterinary profession.
Yeah.
But at the core basis of what our daily work is empowering other veterinarians to speak out and feel confident in their beliefs, and students too, especially be like, there are things that need to change in organized veterinary medicine and at our universities. And you guys are the ones to change it. And if you are part of this movement, you will be viewed by the future and by your colleagues as innovators. And do not let what anybody says right now to you dissuade you, because you are on the right side of history.
Yeah, that's a powerful message. And I think there's this weird irony here, because one of the other reasons why the veterinary system is so important, apart from its direct impacts on, you know, the work that's done, is because it does have enormous credibility in the public sphere and in the political sphere and in the legal sphere as well, because of the depth of expertise. So there is that really interesting dynamic, because, you know, the industry and individuals within it have a real opportunity to lead, you know, take a leadership role and talk about where the future is going, the future of animal agriculture, the future of plant agriculture, the future of animal testing, hopefully bringing it to an end. And the future of the veterinary science world in trying to enable that and make it happen. But it feels like those currently in charge of veterinary science are at serious risk of being left behind by everybody else, right? The public mood, at least in certain parts around the world, genuinely seems to be shifting. We talked briefly before we started recording that, you know, every human in some sense cares about at least some non-human animals, right? So it seems really weird that this set of institutions seems to actually be lagging behind even where the public are and where even some politicians are going too. So I'm interested in your view about how veterinary science and vets can also link into that political and legal world, and how much value you see in and how much hope you see in the law and policy and regulation and even individual politicians and pushing us in a better way, in a better direction.
Yeah, absolutely. The veterinary profession is very much siloed. Like, we are living in our bubble. And, you know, the California Veterinary Medical Association especially has been against the declaw ban. We wanted to ban declawing here in California. They were against it. We introduced a bill in California that would place a moratorium on the construction of factory farms in California. The California Veterinary Medical Association was against it.
Amazing.
And they the legislators look to them as like, oh, they're the experts on animals. And there's not really a good, powerful other group who is messaging to legislators. So we need to create that other group. Hopefully Our Honor, and obviously Our Honor can't, is a 501c3. We can't talk to legislators directly, or in a, it's, it gets a little tricky. We can't support individual politicians, but other groups can, like Compassionate Bay, which is a group I'm part of, to, we can talk to these legislators, we can introduce bills. And that's what we hope to do. And thankfully, recently Cory Booker just today actually introduced his Industrial Animal Agriculture Accountability Act. And Vox just released an article about this. And he said he was inspired to write this bill because of the whole issue with ventilation shutdown and during the COVID-19 pandemic, when the slaughterhouses faced decreased capacity because all of the slaughterhouse workers got sick. And these pork producers had not put a plan in place to take care of their animals, and their animals had nowhere to go. And so they ended up sealing up barns, pumping in heat and steam, and waiting for the pigs to die. And this
is essentially being cooked to death. I mean, it's that simple, isn't it?
Death of heat stroke. Yeah, it's absolutely horrifying. It took hours. And this is a method that's codified in the American Veterinary Medical Association's guidelines on depopulation as a method to be used in constrained circumstances. But this wasn't an infectious disease outbreak. This was a constrained circumstance created by the industry. And taxpayers ended up having to pay them for killing their pigs this way. And now with avian influenza, we have killed 50 million birds in this country because of influenza outbreaks. And the vast majority of them were killed using this method that was to be used only in constrained circumstances, ventilation shutdown plus heat. And it's absolutely horrifying. And so we tried to twice now introduce a resolution into the AVMA House of Delegates. We got enough signatures that would ask them to reclassify it as not recommended. And the AVMA failed to act. The first time they voted 99.1% to put the question back to the panel on depopulation, which only reviews their guidelines every 10 years. Like, so not with sense of urgency that was demanded. And this time we introduced it again just recently, and they shut us down completely. They gave all of these excuses, like the use of the word heat stroke is inappropriate, even though that's exactly what it is. They didn't like the use of our language, saying that they should change it in the interim. You know, just kind of using their, it really seemed like they cared more about like this pseudo parliamentarian procedure than they actually care about the animals.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Cory Booker, a senator, had her back, and he introduced this act to stop incentivizing these cruel and harmful practices. And he really highlights in this bill how all of the different ways that this industrial animal agriculture model gets all of the benefits and none of the blame. All of the risks are put back onto the taxpayers. And so he wants to do several things in this legislation. One is to prevent injuries to animals and workers in processing plants. And that means putting an end to increasing slaughter line speeds, which we've seen in recent years. They're just continuing to increase what's allowed. And he's going to stop slaughterhouses from self-inspecting, which is something they've done over the recent years. And he's going to ban the use of prison labor for these mass cull events. He's going to ask the industry to prepare for these emergencies, prepare for these slaughterhouse bottlenecks, and create some disaster plans. And he's going to like straight up prevent some of these really inhumane culling methods, like using water-based foam or sodium nitrate, where they're poisoned and die a horrible death, and the mass killing of heat stroke. Via heat stroke. And so he's going to do this by creating this new office in the USDA, which will collect fees from producers to pay for this sort of humane culling methods. And he's going to make poultry producers pay for a severance to staff and healthcare for 2 years for those workers who conduct those mass culls. And he's actually, this is groundbreaking. He's going to amend the 1958 Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, which currently only covers mammals, and it doesn't cover the 98% of animals who were killed. And that is, he's going to finally, you know, have poultry birds covered under that. So that will be fantastic.
I guess it won't go as far as fish yet, but.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wonder, I have to look at the bill a little bit more closely.
Because that'd be interesting to see if they can extend to all sentient beings, including fishes. But maybe that's too much to ask for. But there's real hope in that. Again, it's in the political arena, it's part of this process of, you know, the people who talk about non-human animals being seen as, you know, freakish, on the edge, on the fringe. You know, yes, there are animal parties here or there, but they're largely ignored. To them building a bit of momentum, actually, you know, they might be a small party, but they still, you can see them nudging the impact on the policies of the bigger parties, and slowly having more individual politicians taking these issues seriously and being willing to face the social reputational costs of, you know, having the authenticity and the integrity to show that they care and standing up and pushing some of these things forward. So yeah, there's hope there. So
yeah, big risk for him. Like, yeah, you know, this is very, the animal ag industry is like the most powerful lobbyists in our country. Yeah. And he's going against those guys. So it's going to be a huge battle. And I can't wait to see what happens. I hope the people support him, obviously, but that doesn't matter in the United States. It doesn't matter that the vast majority of people support you. It matters if those in power, those with the money and the influence support you. And unfortunately, right now, that's animal agriculture.
And there's a really powerful analogy between the story that we understand about big tobacco and then through to big oil and through to big animal ag. And in many cases, it's the same lobbyists and PR firms who went to the animal ag companies and said, look what we did for tobacco. We delayed regulation by 30 years by, you know, lobbying and bullshit. And it's exactly the same playbook now. It's a phenomenal thing to have to fight against. But
and unfortunately, veterinarians are those merchants of doubt, just like the scientists used,
part of the story,
were used by the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry. Now it's veterinarians who are merchants of doubt for the animal ag industry, which is quite disturbing. And so, I think we just have to tell them they can't use us that way anymore. That's not going to fly.
Yeah, exactly. And how does all of that leave you feeling about, you know, our prospects of making a better world? Because it feels to me as though, you know, the veterinary industry has enormous power and credibility and could really take a leadership role, taking us to a different place. And within that community, you're absolutely taking a leadership role in trying to shift that institution so it can then have that positive impact. And do you feel, you know, optimistic, pessimistic, somewhere in between about the prospects for, you know, a future veterinary system that genuinely really does have the best interests of its patients at heart? Do you think you'll get there?
Personally, I think it is definitely possible. We have the numbers on our side, but there are a lot of power structures in place. The AVMA puts up in positions of influence those people who they know will benefit the pharmaceutical companies and animal agriculture. Can we infiltrate it from the inside? I don't know. Or will we need to start a whole nother thing? The AVMA has had since 1850, I think, to like build up their thing. They have their journal. They have all of this infrastructure in place. To start from scratch would be incredibly hard.
Yeah.
But I think it's all in the hands of people and people believing that this is possible. I think it's so funny when you talk to people, it's like, yeah, these things should change, but they'll never change. Really, the only thing that's lacking is hope. Like if every single person who's like, yeah, this should change, but it just won't, goes like, yeah, it should change and it will, and it's going to change, like that, just hope is so powerful. I mean,
I totally agree. I think one of the reasons social change is so hard is because people use the fact it's hard as an excuse not to do anything. I'm like, You know, that with the sentence you just said is exactly part of the problem. It's, and it is weird that it's one of the recurring themes in this series of conversations, because on the one hand, there is this sort of latent human sentiocentric ethic. You know, almost every human already cares about at least some non-human animals. So we can tap into that. You know, in a sense, we've sort of almost won the argument about should we needlessly cause harm and death to other sentient beings. I mean, most people intuitively would just say, well, no, of course not. I'm on your side. So we have that latent ethic. We have the technical solutions to many of these problems, or at least they're within reach. You know, for example, in agriculture, we have plants which are edible. So we already have the answer, right? So it's not, I'm not saying there isn't a transition to work through and there aren't challenges, but it's not like we need to invent something or that's physically impossible to solve this problem. It's staring us in the face. And as you've also said, these aren't even difficult trade-offs. In some cases, there's like win-win-wins that are mind-bendingly obvious for, you know, humans, non-human animals, and the environment we all share. So the blockers really do seem to be some of the things you focused on, which are just, you know, social norms through things like 4-H indoctrination and institutional power structures and political structures that really just don't want stuff to change. But all of those things really are just, you know, amalgams of human decisions, and we can change our minds. So, and your work is deeply inspirational in, you know, with real bravery, pushing that agenda forward. And I share your hope. I share your hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Yours as well. This podcast is great. I wish all the vet students need to watch it or listen to it.
Thank you, Wolf. Feel free to share it. And I do think, you know, if only fewer people were listening to Joe Rogan and Russell Brand and Deepak Chopra, and, you know, the list could go on, right? Then, and more of them were listening to us, I think, you know, the world would be a better place. So that's another lever we can pull. Although with my tiny audience, I'm not sure it's going to have much of an influence yet, but thank
you. Maybe you should go on Joe Rogan. And yeah. Well, everybody listening to this podcast should message Joe Rogan and be like, hey, have Jamie Woodhouse on.
Maybe we could have like a 4.5-hour conversation, and the back end of it, he'd go vegan and denounce his meat diet. And, you know, let's see. There's a challenge for me.
So I've been trying to get somebody on a show, some activist person who can go to war.
Maybe that's the way forward.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing your philosophical journey and your amazing work. What's the best way of people following you, supporting you, learning more about R on R, checking your TikTok?
Yeah, so I keep forgetting about my TikTok. I am every day on Twitter, Dr. Crystal Heath. That's where, like, you can get my minute-to-minute thoughts on things. And then R on R has a Twitter. Our Honor has a Facebook and an Instagram. I have my own Instagram and Facebook as well. Compassionate Bay, you can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well. And Veterinarians Against Ventilation Shutdown, also on Twitter and Instagram. So follow them there. And then ourhonor.org is our website. And VAVSD.org is Veterinarians Against Ventilation Shutdown. Check that out. Compassionate Bay, I think it's CompassionateBay.org or something like that. And yeah, sign up for the R on R newsletter.
I did that yesterday.
Oh, awesome. Cool.
That's great. Thank you.
Out a weekly newsletter on things.
Yeah, and I'll include all those links in the show notes anyway, but it's great to have an overview of the vast range of different things you're trying to drive. So yeah, thank you again for being a part of Sentientist Conversations. It was such a pleasure. Please stay in touch, Crystal.
Nice to talk to you too. Thank you.
Take care. Have a good day.
You too.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?